G'day, and welcome to The Edge Show, episode number...
51?
51.
Hey, that spells 51.
You got it. And you were on 50.
I was on 50.
Does it feel like a whole year has passed?
There was no cake. I'm so disappointed.
Golnaz, fix that. We need cake. That'll work.
We need cake. It will. We have news.
Yeah, two items of interest. Well, kind of three-ish. Two are related, and one is kind of not related at all, but... Do you want me to start off?
Sure, why not?
Okay,
kick it off.
TechEd North America insider's email went out yesterday, I think. I saw it on the Twitters that it was now available for information. People have been asking about what's going on with TechEd for registration. It was in like 17 weeks, and there was still no registration open. So officially, registration will be open on... What's the date? February 12th. Is the registration date.
Absolutely. And TechEd North America this year, June 3rd through the 6th in New Orleans, Louisiana.
No. Nolens. Even I know that, and I'm a Canadian.
Nolens,
eh?
N-A-W.
Nolens. You got it. Nolens. 25th to 28th. Going to be a blast. And we have a additional TechEd that is also open for registration. Not taking place at the same time, but registration opens at the same time. And that is TechEd Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. TechEd Europe this year is going to be in Spain.
I've never been.
We'll be in Madrid, Spain. We're going to be there June 25th through the 28th.
Okay.
And again, registration opening on February 12th. Early bird registration just for both conferences, and so everybody knows early bird registration. Register now. If you're registering for TechEd North America, you'll save $300. If you're registering for TechEd Europe, you will save €300. Oh,
okay.
And registration will be on www.msteched.com. So one single place, two fantastic conferences.
Now, are you going to be there?
I'm going to be at both, actually.
Can I come to both, too?
I don't know. We'll have to see if you can get a permission slip, okay?
Okay. We'll see see if I get my visas to go through.
We will be there. Yes, absolutely. And more to come.
Okay.
More to come. And, you know, last year, we did quite a bit around TechEd.
It was a lot of fun last year. We got to do some entertaining things leading up to TechEd and some other things. We are still waiting for... I'm waiting for approval to be able to do them again. I don't know about you, but maybe you've already been cleared. I don't know. But we'll have lots of periodic news and updates about TechEd in the upcoming weeks that's going on.
Yeah, so stay tuned. Again, June 3rd through the 6th in New Orleans, Louisiana, and June 25th through the 28th in Madrid, Spain, TechEd North America, and TechEd Europe, respectively.
Registration?
February 12th. February. Don't remember. Don't forget early bird reg. Okay. Enough with TechEd.
Okay. Another really cool thing that is out. Joey, I'll actually let you do this one since you're the client guy. I'm the server guy, so go ahead, man.
We're going to talk about Surface.
Well, Surface RT, it's out. It's old. It's new. It's been around for a while, dude. That's like old news.
Yes.
Skip it.
But this is Surface Pro.
Okay.
And Surface Pro...
So it's what? It's thicker? It comes with gold wings or something? Like what?
Wow. somebody really... You should really pay attention to your Twitter feed.
I'm sorry.
I'm just saying. So Surface Pro is going to be released February 9th of this year. Now, Surface Pro, this is a little different than the Windows RT version. This is full Pro version of Windows 8.
Okay.
That means the applications that you're used to running... All of those, you know, out-of-the-box applications that you can get, your favorite news readers, some of those things, those standard .msi installation
yep.
Applications will run on this device. It's a Core i5 device. And I know you will love this part.
What?
It comes with a pen.
Ah, okay, see, I'm a digitizer kind of guy, so that means the digitizer's there. Will that digitizer work on my RT? Like, can I use the pen on my RT device?
I don't have the answer to that said question.
And the answer is no, it won't.
Okay.
Because there is no digitizer
hardware. You know better than I do. You did read your Twitter.
I was setting you up. I was setting you up for the answer. Make you look even like SMRT-er. But no, the pen and the digitizer is only available in the Pro Edition. And that's one of the reasons why I'm holding out for the Pro Edition. I have my RT. Actually, I don't have my RT. My wife has my RT. She's taken it away from me. I have the Corp one that I have, which I use for my notes and my meetings, stuff like that. But I'm missing the ability to write on it. Can't wait. Digitizer. It's in the Pro version.
February 9th. Available in the United States and Canada.
Now, where can you get it?
Like at MicrosoftStore.com.
Yep.
Your favorite local Microsoft store. And actually, in the United States, We will have it available at Best Buy and Staples, and then there will also be some retailers to be announced up there in the Great White North.
Oh, nice. I believe if you actually go to one of those locations, like for instance the Microsoft store, if you happen to have one there, they'll actually give you a lot more information. Cannot confirm, they do not have devices for you to go off and touch and play with, that I can tell, but they will give you more information about it there if you're interested, if you are able to walk in, because I know I got an email invite to say, why don't you come by the store and talk about Pro?
That's awesome.
That was cool.
That's awesome.
They don't want me to talk about Pro. They want to talk to me about Pro.
Yes.
You got it.
Absolutely. Also, one other bit of news regarding the Surface. Surface for Windows RT, which has been out, has been available in Australia, Canada, China, France, Germany, Hong Kong, the UK, also, of course, here in the United States. We're expanding availability for Surface for Windows RT to an additional 13 markets, Austria, the Netherlands, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, among others. Mm-hmm. Those will be announced in the coming weeks. Okay. So stay tuned for that bit of news. Again, the place to go check that out is Microsoft.com/Surface. Or of course, if you are in the market on February 9th and you're looking to get that Surface Pro, it's MicrosoftStore.com or your favorite Microsoft Store.
Nice.
So that kind of wraps up the news that we had. I mean, kind of short, quick, and easy. Who are you talking to today, my friend?
Well, it's actually an interesting little edit we're going to be doing today. I have lined up a guy from the Hybrid Storage Group. It used to be known as the File Server Group, now they're the Hybrid Storage Hardware Group. A couple episodes ago, I had this thing about John Lovall and Cluster in a Box.
Yep.
But it was this box that wasn't powered on. It was prototype hardware, stuff like that. I've actually got my hands on a Cluster in a Box device that is from Quanta. And he is going to actually walk me through the setup of this device from the EULA all the way through and talk about what the experience is going to be like. And so I figured, hey, that'd be a great interview.
Sounds fantastic to me.
That one there is going to be up. It might be a little bit long, 20-ish minutes. That's going to be edited into this one here. But stay tuned after the break for Graham Whiteley and Cluster in a Box.
Awesome.
G'day, I'm Rick Claus, Senior Technical Evangelist at Microsoft. And today I have in my office Graham Whiteley, Product Manager for Hybrid Storage Systems. And in the background, you might hear a little bit of fan noise because he's actually leaning on the box that we're going to be configuring today, known as Cluster in a Box. Graham, welcome.
Thank you, Rick. Pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what this is, this device that I'm looking at right now.
So what we've done in the Hybrid Storage Group here is we're started thinking of different form factors for the different markets. So this is a 2U, two server blades, and storage, all in one enclosure.
No extra extraneous cables. It has external accessibility if you want to expand upon it, but it's all contained inside one, as you mentioned before, one piece of tin.
Right, and the architecture, what we've done here is exactly that. We've taken a SAS JBOD infrastructure and stuck it inside the same box as two server blades. And so basically what we've done is eliminated all the cabling you would need to build a highly available cluster.
Now, to me, eliminating cabling means a lot less complexity, a lot ease of deployment to me.
The cabling is still inside, but it could be in traces or it could be in cables depending on the manufacturer.
Yeah.
The system we have today, they took the approach of using a SAS expander.
Yep.
And so they created a new board, a SAS expander board for each server blade, and then those are interconnected across the backplane. And on top of that, they've added a backplane NIC for doing cluster heartbeat.
Okay.
And so all that now, instead of being on outside the box and you would connect to an external JBOD, is inside the box.
Okay.
And so we call this Cluster in a Box. And what we really want to show today is the ease of use on how to cable this,
okay,
and then how the install goes to create a two-node cluster.
Okay.
So what we've done, we brought this system into your office, and all we've done is we've added power cables and a pair of network cables, right? A pair of network cables for each node,
mm-hmm,
right? And so one is on a private NIC, and the other cable we hooked was for the board management controller.
Okay.
And that's how we're looking through this right now, is through the board management controller. and it has a video redirected to our screen here.
Yeah. So we're looking at one of the boxes. Both of them are powered on right now, and we're going to somehow manage to configure this out of the box just on boot up.
Just on boot up. And okay. So what we're seeing here is we're at our EULA screen, and we're going to get in. We're going to go and accept this. And the important thing I want everyone to take away from this is we're going to do everything on one node. The other node we're never even going to touch. We're not even going to go look at it. It's just going to get all the commands we do on this node, which need to be done on the other node, will be done.
Okay.
And that's the secret sauce we've added in the initial configuration task, out of band management.
And this is all just pre-installed by the OEM.
Right. Absolutely. Right. And we should hit on that a bit because these are OEM devices. The OEMs are going to build them, and then they are going to lay an image down on them and then ship them to the customers. And this is at the point the customer has just turned it on and cabled it.
Okay, good.
So we're going to set, and we get our settings, what region you want to be, get some language settings, pretty normal Windows stuff right now.
And that's new.
This is the thing, right? We're going to go out and go configure the second node.
Wow. So it's now, it's almost logging you in. Got some stuff going on.
So with that last little PowerShell screen there, that was going out and identifying our network configuration.
Yep.
So that would be in a file which the OEM would have pre-configured for the network stack he has in his or her device.
Yep.
Can we call it a his or her device?
Yeah, it's ambiguous enough.
Yeah, there we go. Successful connection. As you can see, the first status is connect to second node. And the status is connected.
Okay, so both nodes are talking. Or this is like the primary node. It's already talking to the back to the second node automatically.
Automatically.
It's all good.
And we're only on the one node. I like this right now. This is good.
No KVM required.
So at this point, I'm thinking, you know, we should be done in 30 to 40 minutes. We should have a two-node cluster created, which is a pretty good time. So let's just get through this, and we'll start right now and get going.
Okay.
So we see that we got connectivity. Now what's really good here is that we can look in and say, we had the OEM, they went in and they identified their networking stack. And so they're all the network on the back of the server. And so they've indicated that they want a green, an internal black plane, and a blue. And the OEM, hopefully at this point, you know, when we plugged our cables in, we plugged our green cable into the green and we plugged our blue into blue. They had color-coded it,
yep.
You know, the network configuration at the back of the machine, and the same thing on the second node. So if we wanted to at this point, we could go in and look at our IP configuration on another node, even though we're using DHCP addresses. This, we could go in from this node and look at the IP. So is that something we'd want to see? We're just going to go in here and look at the second node.
So the you're using remote app to get to the second node. I got it.
Now, this is going to fail.
No, it's going to time out and go to the second one. And I can edit out our audio comments and cut this down.
Okay.
So you can't see it.
Have you seen it do that?
Did it with my last install.
Interesting. How long did timeout wait for the timeout?
Okay.
Let's make a note of that because...
There it is.
Now, how do we know which address it connected through?
Because it only has either the back plane or it has the green to go to. That's it.
But it was trying to use the PIP address.
It was trying to use the blue network, which wasn't even turned on, or it was using the backplane address, one or the other. I don't know which one it was, which one it defaulted to first.
Yeah.
It doesn't appear as though it was the same one that it's using to talk to the second node, which would make sense, right? Don't move the mouse. Leave it. You're gonna pick it up with a nice clean audio clip and say, "Look, we're now looking at the networks of the second box."
So here we are now looking at the networks at the second box. At this point, we can look at properties, and we want to look at the properties on our group. It's on our network for Corp Contoso. And so it's just like you're driving on the second node on the first node.
So he's already DHCP. We could hard code him with addresses if you wanted to, but
absolutely.
We'll just stick with DHCP for now.
Just for today, yes. So the next thing we can go into, we're back on the ICT screen, and we can set time zones. We're going to go down. We're in the right time zone.
Yep.
Still in the Pacific here. And we're going to provide our cluster name and our domain name. So we're going to pre-populate these names. And so our domain, as we just said, was...
This is corp.contoso.com.
corp.contoso.com. And the domain username is this should work, domain, the corp administrator.
Yeah.
And then now.
Super secret password.
The super secret password is still hidden. Now what this will do should go off and just validate that what we did is correct.
Okay.
And if it isn't, it should pop back saying you've entered the password incorrectly or the user incorrectly. Not go off and try to join the domain yet. Okay, a cluster management name, do we have one for this?
Is this going to be, this is for our storage?
Right, this is going to be a storage, so we can call it,
scale a file server?
Yeah. What? So when we do it, should FSSC, FSSO, file server scale out?
Sure.
Now, you notice here at this point, we also can do a node name change. So the image which was on the servers is a sys-prepped image from the OEM. So right now it has
that lovely public-generated name
public
that it does.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. And so we want to fit this into our organization, so we're going to change the name at this time as well to fit into how we want it to do.
So you can use whatever naming convention that you want to use for your channel
cluster. Absolutely. And add any more accounts.
Yeah.
So if you have a storage admin account you want to use to manage the storage,
mm-hmm.
Then this would be you would do that as well. And now we need to assign a new password. So at this point,
same one.
I have a password already chosen, so I'm going to use that, and then I'm going to go next, and a little
summary.
Summary. A little progress.
But this isn't doing the big massive cluster validation stuff at this point?
No, all we're doing right now is
getting ready to make the cluster.
Joining the domain, doing a name change, and populating the CNO right, for the cluster.
Yep. All pass with green, that's good.
And now we can do a restart, and we don't have to go to the second node. Both nodes will be restarted.
Ah, good point.
It's okay, no second node. And so at this time, because we just joined a domain, and my next steps are going to be configure storage and clustering, we need to be doing this as the domain admin.
Yep.
And so, as you notice, we're at the local admin screen here, so we'll have to go back and log in with the domain user.
Okay. Got to put corp in front.
Again, happening. So you wait, and the ICT screen will follow up. It just takes a few seconds, and there we go. And it'll go through some of the initialization tasks here. And these initialization tasks are just making sure it can get connected to the second node again.
And what's the technology that's doing that in the background?
The technology.
Like how is it communicating with the second node? How is it configuring the second node?
So all we're doing here at this point is using PowerShell and remote PowerShell commands.
Okay.
So we're doing the using the remoting features in Windows Server 2012.
Nice.
So some of the stuff which we enabled in the OEM would have enabled would have been PowerShell remoting, and that would have been enabled, and they would have put all the firewall opens, you know, all the sockets that you need open to pass all the WinRM commands.
Cool.
Okay. So
I can see the cluster name now. I see that we're part of a domain, and it's also grayed out. What's up with that?
So what we do is when the OEM creates this, and don't forget, this is a template which the OEM would take, and the form and the colors may change to how an OEM would like it to appear. But the code in the back of this tool, you do something, and then it, one of the things is it grays out to show you that that step is being completed, and you can't go back in and do it now. So if I try to hit, right, it's done. And so to the admin who's doing this, it gives them a guidepost that, okay, I've completed that task.
Yep.
And so there's the usual enable Windows error reporting if you want to participate in the customer improvement. We're going to move on, and what we've done here now is that there are different ways that storage can be configured. As you see, the first heading is install and register an SMIS provider. So if you had, say, rated controllers managing the storage in this device, and the vendor for that rated storage card provided an SMIS provider, then we could then configure the storage directly itself. So basically, an SMIS provider is a way to talk to a vendor's storage without using their tools.
Yep.
In this case, we know that the storage here we're using is a SAS HBA, right? And the SAS HBA, we know that we're going to use it to work with the new feature in Windows Server 2012 storage pools.
Okay.
Okay. So one of the first things that we have to do here is we need to go ahead and create a storage pool.
Okay. And you're going to create it through the ICT?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. What ICT here, what its main purpose is to set up steps for you, and what you'll see what it does is just going to launch the storage pool wizard.
Okay.
And new storage pool wizard. And so, of course, should we give some folks an introduction to what storage pools are? And do you want to talk about that?
Let's step through the wizard, and we can talk about it at the same time, just because I know the wizard takes a couple of steps to go through. But basically, the whole concept behind storage spaces and storage pools, it allows you to abstract the drives into groupings of drives or pools of drives, and you can carve those up into resilient disks as part of your storage pool.
So what I see here is I have a bunch of different disks here. Right? Yep. It looks like they're all SAS. Right, and then some they say are Talus 2, and then some are ST.
Yeah.
And so I know that all the Talus 2s are SSDs, and so I'm going to select all the Talus 2s and make them into pool 1. Does that make
sense? That makes sense.
Yeah. Now,
nice fast disk to be able to use for the workload.
And if I just go ahead and create a pool. Now, is there anything else I need to be aware of here if I needed to configure pools?
Well, typically you would group your disks together by speed and by access to it. If there were multiple enclosures, there aren't multiple enclosures in this situation, it would be smart enough to know just to group the different disks that you're going to be making together inside that pool to pull them from the different enclosures when you make the next part, which is your virtual disk that's coming up next.
So one of the things I've learned about creating with pools and stuff and is that you sort of look at what your workload is going to be.
Right.
And then you basically create the pools to match that workload.
Right.
And at this point, we know our workload on the server that we're configuring is going to be a storage server. And so we are going to have this pool. And does it really then we have to do some mirroring to it for some resiliency?
Yep.
And so we've created this, but a pool, and then from a pool we need to create a virtual disk wizard. And let's close this off. And I just want to show people that the size of the pool we just created.
Okay.
And the size of the pool we now have is 1.81 terabytes of storage, right?
Yep.
So really, we don't have a disk yet, right? it says two physical disks because there are two other disks in this unit, right, which are just rotational media disks. And it's just identifying them as just a bunch of disks, right, part of the JBOD. But we still need a volume and a disk so that we can then, for clustering, and I think what we'll do is we'll take this pool, this storage pool, and divide it into two virtual disks.
Okay, we need to have one for the clustering side of things, one for quorum, and then also one for the actual data.
Okay. And so we'll call this our, we'll do this first, right? Do a quorum disk. That makes sense?
Sure.
Okay. And mirror for some reliability, not works for me.
Sure.
Two-way mirror, right? Fixed is because it's still it's for clustering and mm-hmm. we can only use a fixed disk. So size-wise, we don't need terabytes for a quorum. So
no, nice and small.
Small these days is nice 10 gigabyte. Even that's probably oversizing.
Yeah, that's fine.
And we'll go off and create that. Now, this next thing, the part we should create the volume at the same time. So we can go through and create the volume. And that looks good. Any reason? Just take the defaults here for now.
So now that shows up to the systems as a mappable drive. They can actually see that now and they can use it.
Right, and we should see that shortly, right?
Yep.
We see now here, we have a volume D. And we'll go back in now and let's create our data disk. Select our pool. And then here, I'm just going to use whatever's left, right? Just for the sake of showing people that, keep it simple.
And this is the volume piece to it now?
Correct. And so that's about right. It's about half. It's a mirror, so 912. So all this storage is being created, and when we do create the storage, then the second node will pick up on this storage through, if you went to Disk Manager mm-hmm. right now, you would be able to see that the disk is online on one node and offline on the other node. So the next step then is we can run cluster validation. And cluster validation, how many steps are in cluster validation?
I don't know off by heart, but I know it does like over 100 and some odd right. change checks against all the right. different configuration settings to make sure that all is happy. It's great thing that came out with 2008R2, but then it's gotten even better with this type of implementation.
So we haven't been doing this for long.
No, it's been pretty quick.
It's been pretty quick, and we're at the point where we're going to create a two-node cluster. Is that surprising?
I think it could be, yeah.
It could be.
It's going quite fast. I like how it does this. Collect the information and kind of hold back on right. actually doing the steps until it's ready to go.
So here we are. We're going to
automatically detect the two nodes.
Connected that we have two nodes. Know that we have a cluster name for it. Now we're going to hit validate.
Yep.
And then the validation will go off. And really, this is going to launch the cluster validation wizard, mm-hmm. which is if you're using the regular cluster management tools, would do the same thing.
Yep.
And so hit validate. And we can get a little progress steps telling us how the validation goes. So this looks good. This is the same report you would get from the cluster validation wizard. And we have the option of going in and looking at it, and we shall. So, and we have a one warning, and the warning is about, is that we have multiple networks in this configuration, and our blue network is not IP'd because we don't have it connected.
Right.
And the other warning we see here is the internal backplane. And this is the internal backplane I talked earlier about, which is on the SAS expander, which allows node-to-node communication. And really, that's there for cluster heartbeat. Mm-hmm. And in the effect that the node lost its connectivity to its external, the unit would still function and maintain its cluster formation. And then the other thing it noticed was that the multiple adapters are on the same subnet. And that would be reporting because both the blue and the internal backbone are using the APIPA address, right? Which is the 169 address. And I believe that is the only set of warnings that we had. And so it's always good to go in and check your cluster validation and make sure that you understand what the warnings are before you go on. And because the next, what we're going to do is we're going to create the cluster.
Yep.
So let's move on, create cluster. There's a name we had picked before, earlier. There we go. And at this time, we have an option that we can create a highly available file server. And this is good because, the way we wanted the OEM, we purchased this as a storage appliance. And so we're going to get this set up now with a file server, right? Scale out file server, highly available file server to handle our storage. So when we do our workload, which is Hyper-V over SMB, connecting to the storage on this cluster in the box. And earlier, we had talked about what kind of workloads the cluster in box is suited for.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is probably more a cluster in box scenario, which is a mid-market scenario. The other scenario is to have this box as a Hyper-V appliance, where everything would be in the box, and Hyper-V would run over clustered shared volumes inside the box, and it would probably, in this case, would be active-passive. In the configuration that we're working on right now, is this is going to be a storage box, and the nodes are going to be active-active. And so really what that gives us then for our Hyper-V's servers, we can have multiple paths into this box, right? And each node is able to serve requests.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're getting use of all the processing in here and all the memory and all the workload capabilities. So we got success. We have a cluster. I'm going to close this and we'll go back to ICT. It'll done the same as before. It's validated. And we are now have a two node cluster.
Great.
So at this point, there's two things that we can do. We could, there is one other option in the ICT, and that is to turn on clusterware updating. And we've, haven't really talked about this, but this is a new feature added into Windows Server 2012, which helps you basically do the maintenance. Customers have asked for a way to manage cluster updating. And so when you have to do your patches and stuff, this tool now will work with Windows Update Service and allow you to patch your clusters. And what it'll do, it sort of just looks at the, its algorithm, sort of it looks at which is where the least amount of I/O is happening, and that's the node it would update first. And then it would drain that node from the cluster, all the workloads off of it, and the other node then would pick those up, and then it would go into that, and then it would take the other node down and do the same thing, and put the workloads exactly how they were when you came back, when you started the update.
Well, let's go into the cluster manager to be able to go in and take a look and see if the share's ready to go, because I want to actually test this out and put a workload against this guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do that. During the ICT, we asked the ICT to create us a traditional file server role on the cluster. So this is a file server role which you would use for information worker workload.
Yeah, like now, your office docs,
right,
and stuff like that.
Stuff like that. what we want to create is we want to have a scale-out file server role, because we're going to be using a server workload, in our case Hyper-V, but it could be as well SQL. And so we're going to do, the workload is going to be over SMB. So we'll create this scale-out file server. It'll have clustered shared volume, and then we'll add a share for our Hyper-V workload for our virtual disk then to reside on this share.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we'll go into roles, and we'll configure a role. And from this point, we want to just grab the file server. And what's really good now is that when you create a file server role, you get the two choices. File server for general use, which we just created a highly available file server role. And now we're going to create a scale-up file server for application data. We need to name this, so we're going to name this SLFS, scale-up file server. Go next. And as simple as that. We had the expected error because we're doing this in real time and we're not really waiting for Active Directory. So we waited like 5-6 minutes here now, and Active Directory has populated the information. And so now, when I go in and I want to create my file share, we should get the file share wizard. There we go. Retrieving server configuration. Now we'll continue on and create our file share for our Hyper-V server. And again, this is great because we get it. It's very quick. You can understand SMB share, a little description, and we want to do an application. This is for Hyper-V. And go next. We want to do it on our scale-out file server, and now we're going to create a clustered share volume, okay?
Uh-huh.
And it's going to be the full size of what we selected for that storage, which we assigned to the scale-out file server. And we're going to call this a name, which is, I like to use virtual machines. And go next. And then, as you notice, that this is the key, this is the great feature we've added in Server 2012, right, is continuously available file share.
I also like the option that you can, don't need to turn it on, but I like the fact that we can now actually support encrypted clustered shared volumes.
Right.
From a security perspective. That's a new thing in 2012.
Yeah. And we all, there are some great features in Server 2012, and if you haven't tried them, it's time to get out there and give them a try. I know we've been excited about it.
So now at the bottom here, I see the virtual machines is now set up and available, and it is continuously available.
And that's what we want, right? Okay, so continuous availability, right?
So I can now hit this guy with my Hyper-V box, which is over here.
Right, and you're going to
I'm going to start the install process.
Sure.
Of something.
You have another box? Let's go and take a look.
Okay. I'm just going to go ahead and make a new virtual machine. And you're telling me that I can make it and use that new share that we just created.
That's what the whole idea is. We have a clustered share volume on a cluster in a box. And you'll be able to have highly available Hyper-V.
Okay, so that was S.
That was scale-out file server, SOFS. And I think virtual machines there populates for us.
Perfect. Go. Select that as the destination for the machine's going to be stored. It's given some RAM, dynamic memory, connected up to the Contoso network. He's going to use the hard drive, and then this is where the VHD file is going to be stored on SOFS, which is correct.
Yeah.
And I'll say install an operating system. I've got an ISO file here that I can just use for the install process. Finish. It configures it. Now, this is just simply a domain joined Hyper-V box is not highly available. It's just a member server.
Right,
it's just
a member server, but the Hyper-V virtual machine you've created now is on a continuously available file share.
Right, so here we are once again. SOFS, there's the file share and where it's all located. So let's just spin this guy up. I'm just going to start the install process here.
So we saw in settings that we're on that file share. So one of the things which I like to show people now is while this is happening, what happens if this we do something over here, we move the storage, right, the share.
While we're doing the install.
So if we know right now, we see our scale-out file server, the owner node is N1.
Yep.
What if we move that to N2? I want to wait till this starts so people can see that this is copying files. And then during that copy, we'll do a move.
Sure.
And we'll move to the N2 node as the owner node.
So here he is booting, coming up. So let me go ahead and start the copy process. Install. Data center core. License terms. Custom install, take the drive. Go ahead and start the copy process. There we go. He's definitely chugging away. He's running in RAM, but he's also obviously writing to the VHD file, with VHDX file, which is up on that SharePoint.
So he's at 1%.
Yep. 3.
Oh, okay. So 4. Back over. So we can come here and we can just do a move, select the node. We know that we're going to get N2.
This isn't going to break anything with my box as he's running.
Well, that's what we're going to show, right? That this is continuously available.
Okay.
And so when I interpret continuously available, I expect that workload
should continue to work,
which is a creation of a should continue.
Yep.
What happened over there?
Boom. That node number 2 now, and over here he's at 10, 11.
So he's keep on going, right? He's,
yeah.
Nothing's really changed. So
even though the file handles are open and things are being written to,
right.
Everything all is...
We can move it back down. 1 was there. Still.
Still no blip whatsoever.
How about we then do a reboot?
Reboot of one of the boxes.
Yeah. What would the expectation be here for you?
That to me, and if I was thinking of clustering, that would mean that the whole thing would basically have to fail over to the other side.
Right.
And there'd be loss of service.
And there'd be loss of service, right? So anyway, the good thing is...
So what's the machine name on this guy again that we're looking at?
So we're looking here. We're at FSSO N1. That's the owner node.
That's the owner node. But which one are we actually logged into?
So which one are we logged on? Let's do host name. So we're on node 1.
So you can actually just issue a shutdown command with a restart on this guy?
Sure. I'm going to do a restart. Can I spell restart? Go to PowerShell command, restart computer. And what's happening over here?
Over here, 36%.
All right, so node one's off.
37%, 38%.
So you would think that you're still going and you're continuously available.
Yeah, it's still chugging along.
Right. So we just wait. He's on a restart. He'll come back up and, you'll continue. There's no stoppage. Everything is continuously available. Now, in the past, what we had seen, right, you would see, there would have been some I/O interrupted and stuff.
Yep.
But I think in Server 2012, they did a very good job. Bring in continuously available file shares,
mm-hmm.
and SMB, this is all over, and so SMB3 gives us this capability now of keeping our workloads and our transactions continuously available.
So the longest part of building this whole thing was the cluster validation wizard, in my opinion. Looking at this now, that was probably the longest chunk of time we were waiting for this to go through, was the standard cluster validation checklist. Right. There were some reboots that happened as well,
yeah.
But we're out of the box, up and running, 20, 30 minutes from beginning to end.
Well, it was more, it's probably, yeah.
With the wait times. I mean,
we
had the validation wizard, and we also had to wait for Active Directory to kind of settle down with the naming and finding the names of the roles that we created.
Right. But what we also need to account for is that we didn't have to do any cabling other than doing power cable and Ethernet.
Yep.
I didn't have to get out the SAS cables and make sure I put them in a high available cross and I plugged them into the right paths.
Mm-hmm.
And You know, in the image that we got from the OEM, you know, they knew that this was going to be a spaces configuration, and they had set all the right parameters already in that image. So, so they had turned on some services already, right? For sure, we had failover clustering was installed, file server role was installed, MPIO was installed, so we had a multipath for the disks. And so those things had been pre-configured as well. I mean, but we save all those steps when it gets to the customer. All he has to do is go through this initial configuration wizard, set up the stuff which isn't usually available, you know, the OEM doesn't know per customer, and now he's up and running, and you're right, in the 30 or 40 minutes, his cluster is ready to go in.
So awesome.
Awesome is a good term.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot for taking the time to show us the setup. I mean, before I saw the box, and I just was able to kind of touch it and look at the architecture and stuff like that, but actually seeing it created in front of my eyes and now sharing with these guys, is great. Thanks
right.
a lot for taking the time.
And one other thing, we just want to make sure, Rick, you're going to take this cluster in a box and you're going to evangelize this, and now you're going to get to use this system in exactly the same way we're going to have our customers do it.
Yep.
You're going to be re-imaging it and you're going to be setting it up for shows and stuff.
Oh, yeah, no, I plan on definitely having some good blog posts up there about my experiences with it, how it was used, and that sort of stuff. So I'll make sure that I leave information back with you and also with the rest of the people here to be able to follow along and see how it's going.
Rick, thank you very much for having us today.
Anyway, thanks for coming in.
All right. Bye.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right. Cluster in a box. Really cool solution.
Uh-huh.
And is that what all the fan noise is down?
Well, next
door
to you,
to me.
That's the reason why it's a little bit hotter with the air conditioning. We have that inside a noise reduction enclosure, but it's still a little bit loud. See if my audio editing can clean it up a little bit. We'll see.
Yep.
But yeah, temperature definitely goes up because you got 12 drives in there and lots of fans, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but it's something that it is portable. It's all self-contained, wicked looking stuff.
Awesome, awesome. Remember, folks, you can send us your feedback. Tweet us at TN Edge. Of course, your comments and star ratings are also appreciated in the post below.
If you're old-fashioned email, you're more than welcome to at edge@microsoft.com. Send us that way, too. And you know what?
That's
this is it, man. This is a wrap. Let's take it to the break. Take it to the end, and we'll see you next time.
See you next week.